Well, we're back on tape, and I noticed that you do. We talked a little bit about your administrative responsibilities before, just a bit, but I noticed that you do quite a few things. You're on some editorial boards and some study sections, and you are a trainer for a training grant, which I'm not exactly sure what that means. Maybe you could tell me what that's about.
We have a number of NIH-sponsored training grants for that specialize in different programs. Mm-hmm. For example, the medical scientist training program has mm-hmm. one. The aging training grant has one. And individual faculty who have research in the area mm-hmm. of the topic of the training grant, for example, aging or mm-hmm. membrane biology or some mm-hmm. cancer biology. So the PI of the program grant or those who are running the program grant try to get together faculty whose research programs are in the area mm-hmm. that the grant is supposed to be training people in. So I'm someone who has a research program, and thus I'm a legal trainer of students and fellows that are sponsored by that grant. So in the program, if somebody's selecting mm-hmm. a lab to work with or a trainer, mm-hmm. they'll my research program will be described in that brochure that they'll get.
Okay, and I also noticed that you, I guess, help plan these pew meetings. So we have you to thank for the great meetings, right?
Yeah, I participated in 2 out of 4 uh-huh. for the years that I was a pew scholar. And I volunteered for the reunion. Uh-huh. But I suspect many people volunteered.
Well, Puerto Vallarta in January sounds pretty nice. Huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah. But I would have gotten invited anyway.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I didn't. I like it. I like to do those kinds of things because you might be able to, you know, sway the tone of the meeting.
Uh-huh.
But also, particularly for Pew, I have always felt that they have done everything mm-hmm. within their meetings and things about the organization. Like, they sent me a birthday card. Mm-hmm. They remember your birthday. How sweet is that?
Mm-hmm.
They're just very thoughtful. They like for you. They want to make you feel comfortable or good mm-hmm. about things, and that kind of thing makes a difference. And my feeling was, well, how can I do something to repay them, a form mm-hmm. of gratitude or to participate in how they make things nice? And sure. I felt that a way to help out would be to help in planning meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So not only would I maybe have a chance to voice an opinion about what speaker would be invited or what format the meeting itself would have, but also to help serve them because they need input from people, and I know they realize our time is valuable and our opinions are important. So I did it sort of with my conscience
mm-hmm.
speaking to me mm-hmm. at the time.
Okay. Since we're talking about all the things that keep you busy, we haven't touched on the process of writing for publication. And I know that writing the grants is a major headache for you. How about writing papers?
I have a policy with the people in my lab that I require them to write the papers.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people will tell you that it's a mistake, it's a big time sink, it's traumatic for everybody. I view it as part of my responsibility in training them.
Mm-hmm.
I already know how to write papers. I wrote my papers when I was a graduate student. Mm-hmm. I wrote the papers when I was a postdoc. And I had a heavier hand in the first few manuscripts that came out of my independent lab. But if I'm training graduate students to do what I do, and postdocs to do what I do, they have to be able to write their own science, not just to do the experiments or to try to put into perspective mm-hmm. what it means. They have to be able to put down in words in a professional mm-hmm. way what that is. And so I require, almost until the last draft, mm-hmm. that the students and the fellows write their own. Mm-hmm. What I've learned in the process is that very few people know how to make an outline. Mm-hmm. I always start out by telling them, make an outline and make your display items. Mm-hmm. And then we'll sit and talk mm-hmm. about it. If I see things can flow better a different way, whatever. I'm not sure if it has to do with the fact that I'm dealing with a lot of people from different countries who've had different educational experiences, and maybe outlines aren't taught, not standard mm-hmm. in these places. But even some of the Americans that I've had, not as their ability to write an outline is sort of there. It's not what I would have expected it to be. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was a student, I would sit down, look at my work, and then start making an outline. No one told me, make an outline. Mm-hmm. I would make an outline, prepare figures, and then I would go to my mentor and say, I think I have a story that we can write.
Right.
And then we would discuss it. Mm-hmm. And I know it was easier for her to critique that way. It was easier for me to figure out how to rearrange than after the whole thing is written, and if it's going in a direction that it shouldn't be going, then it's so much more labor. So the writing of manuscripts, that's a different kind of a labor. And at times it's tough, but I view that as a main job role, that or job function that I have, to teach people how to write manuscripts. So I'll write margin notes. Sometimes if it's just bad English, I'll try and make it better English. I'm not the best grammarian that's out there, but I can see mistakes that other people make in their written text than I can in my own. Mm-hmm. So that I view as part of my job. That's an important part of my job. And I think that as much as my students have sometimes complained about it, the postdocs haven't really complained about it, but as much as the students have complained about it, they realize how valuable it is. I had one who said, one of my friends in so-and-so's lab doesn't have to write any of her papers, or another one, any of his papers. The mentor just takes the data and writes it up. And I said, is your friend ever going to be able to write a manuscript? When is he or she mm-hmm. going to learn to do that? And how are you going to build a CV without publications? So the labor I consider to be, yes, it's a labor, it's a different kind of labor. I like writing manuscripts because it's important to get the data out there mm-hmm. So that people know what we've found and see if others can find similar things or whatever. So that's a very important part, that it get out there in a timely way. But I also think that if the path of least resistance is having me take their data away and write it, mm-hmm. then I'm really not serving anyone other than myself. Mm-hmm. So I don't I don't do that. Mm-hmm. When it gets to the very end and the manuscript is nearly ripe, then I will add some sentences. But by that point, I've had so many margin notes and so many discussions mm-hmm. back and forth that, you know, my influence has already been there. It's mm-hmm. going to have my tone mm-hmm. to it. Mm-hmm. There'll be certain signature characteristics that mm-hmm. are mine, but they will not have been my sentences, and I will not rewrite somebody else's mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't care what country they were born in and how bad their English is. They were trained in an English-speaking country. They shall write in English, and that is the accepted language among scientists, so yeah. The sooner they get good at it, the better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You use mice in your research, and mice being mammals, how do you feel about animal research in general? I mean, do you have any... I mean, I know you're doing it, but does it bother you at all, or feels okay?
Feels okay.
Okay.
I'm allergic to some animals, yeah. So sometimes it doesn't feel okay, but... Yeah.
Has PETA been after you at all?
PETA has never bothered me.
You. Okay.
Everyone is entitled to their right mm-hmm. to object to something. We're not going to do experiments on people mm-hmm. to find out basic research, mm-hmm. basic answers, or even to find out if a drug that might be good mm-hmm. is going to be good. Mm-hmm. I think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. People have to acknowledge it's necessary that we have some... mammalian system, something close to human, that will give us the opportunity to make a reasonable judgment about, you know, whether or not mm-hmm. a therapy will be effective in humans. That's the only way we're going to be able to make progress. Mm-hmm. So I have no problem with it, and I don't understand that others should have a problem, but if they can propose a better way to do biomedical research and drug development and therapy development and understanding mechanisms of disease, then I guess they should write that up and disseminate it among all the animal researchers so that we can consider it as an option.
Mm-hmm. Are there committees about animal use? I know
I'm on it.
You're on it.
Yeah. 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 If you use animals, then you have to write your animal use protocols. It's right. reviewed by the Animal Institute Committee. And then, so after several years of being here and using many animals, I was invited to be a member of the committee, and then on top of that, I was then recruited to the subcommittee on mm-hmm. animal protocol review. Mm-hmm. So you have to be aware of what government guidelines mm-hmm. are for acceptable practices mm-hmm. for research on animals of all sorts. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the veterinarians, the head veterinarians, are being updated constantly. If anything mm-hmm. is questionable, if procedures come by my desk that I don't know the answer to, mm-hmm. I don't just approve it, assuming that this is reasonable. It's been in mm-hmm. publications before. It could be that now this procedure's been considered unacceptable. That there's a better way. To anesthetize an animal or, you know, to drug an animal.
Right.
Many studies on drug addiction and withdrawal include, you know, dosing animals to make them dependent and then withdrawing and looking at certain signs of withdrawal, and then when do you readminister the drug versus a placebo. And so certain things, you know, a person that would be going through that, that it's terrible. So I just am not sure, because it's outside the area that I'm up to date on. And so often I will question, you know, is this reasonable? Is there another way that this can be done? So, I mean, there are agencies and checkpoints at various levels, and you don't want to have people, there's no need to be using protocols that are outdated, that are now, we now have a better, more quote-unquote humane way of doing an experiment. So there's no need to be using those outdated protocols. But the other thing is that nobody wants to have, because one person isn't adhering to the rules, the entire operation closed down, because that's what can happen. So everyone involved is aware, and the awareness is all in the best interests of everyone and everything. So so I do spend time on that as well. I get lots of homework from them, because every grant deadline, every single protocol has to be approved, and you see,
it's like
every one of those come by your desk. So when my grant deadlines are coming up, that's when my homework increases, because I'll get a stack of 20 or so protocols that I have to read, that other people are using, that I have to say, does it seem appropriate? Are they following all the right guidelines? Is there anything of concern? I raise the concern among the committee members, and then But so my homework ends up going up at the worst possible times.
Yeah. Well, given all of the things that are on your plate, what is the thing that you like the most about being a scientist? And then I'm going to ask you about what you like the least, but let's start with the most.
Yeah, the most is training people to do research. That's what I like the most. I like the freedom that I have as an academician to ask whatever question I think is important and to try to answer it the best way I can, but to take, you know, people that want to learn how to do this and to train them to be able to do it so that it will carry on, that is my greatest joy. I think what I'm most proud of is that everyone that has trained with me so far has gone on to do diabetes and or obesity research beyond that. So they more or less have stayed in the field, which says to me that they liked it. It was a positive experience. One of my students who was MD-PhD is doing her residency now, and so we'll see if when she is beyond that, and she starts establishing herself as an independent, how her research program will develop with her clinical program. So right now that's a little bit up in the air, but those who are in the next phase of their career are all in the field. And that is my greatest joy. The worst, the least favorite. I guess I've said enough that grant writing is stressful. So that makes it not a favorite thing. It has a purpose. It makes you think about things a little bit more critically. It makes you focus your ideas It's, to a certain degree, there's enough uncertainty linked to it. Because you can't stand up in front of the committee that's reading it, and if you didn't write it clear enough, explain to them something that could have been a simple answer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's my least favorite part.
You talked about when these little, you know, when experiments go awry. I think you were talking about when you were in Harvey's lab and how he would, you know, you'd bounce ideas off of him on Saturdays and whatnot. And you referred to those things as mysterious happenings in the lab. And, you know, a lot of times great discoveries happen by accident or by serendipity.
Yeah.
Has that ever happened to you?
No. I don't think I can pinpoint something as being so accidental. I can say that I've started lines of research for one reason, and it became, which I thought was important, and that's why we continue to pursue it, but it became important for a much different reason.
Mm-hmm.
But no, these mysterious happenings that I would be talking about would be more something, a routine protocol that always works. Suddenly one day, and that day just goes on for a lot of days, like for 1 month, won't work. Mm-hmm. And it's something that you just know how to do. It's simple, and why isn't it working? So it would be more, you know, silliness where you would say, oh, the gremlins are back.
Uh-huh.
And then for reasons that you often don't understand, suddenly it starts working again, and then you just let it go. I don't care why it wasn't working before. All I care is that it is working now, and you go on.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't been as lucky, maybe, as to have had something go really wrong and it become a great discovery for me.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Not yet.
Not yet. And I'll welcome it if it happens.
Okay.
But I also have not been unfortunate enough to have ever followed an unproductive track for a very, 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 very long time, you know, where it, I think that, and it's second nature. I don't necessarily credit myself for having purposefully developed insight to when to say no and let go, when is enough, and when you should really keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
I just consider myself lucky that I have made those kinds of decisions, the ones where we have held on and it seemed to be a money sink, and suddenly, thankfully, you know, the good that I thought would come out of it did.
Yeah.
And other things, I feel that I have stopped. It was appropriate because then I'll look in the literature and not see anyone else making progress on it. So I believe there's a certain point where hitting your head against the wall, you have to say, ouch, that hurts, and stop. And sometimes it's just not you, and it's just, it isn't ready to be happening now, and you have to be good at making that decision. And I don't know what has ever guided me or what point in my career development, who taught me this. It could be everybody, it could be nobody. But I'm fortunate in that respect. Mm-hmm. And other people in the lab have noticed that.
Uh-huh.
And I've had students who've turned and said to me, I don't understand how you know when, you know, when is enough, or that we should have gone in that direction. You know, what is the, what was the clue? Mm-hmm. And sometimes the clue is a, is you can't put logic mm-hmm. to it. You can't put science to it. It's a hunch. Mm-hmm. I think we should go in this direction. Often I didn't just pull it out of thin air, but mm-hmm. It's clear there's some gamble attached to it. Mm-hmm. And then other times when to stop. And they've said, we don't think we're ever going to get to a point that we can make these kinds of decisions as efficiently. And I said, this didn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. It just is. And it you know, it will come with time. Don't mm-hmm. worry about it. Mm-hmm. You know, or how do you balance so many things? I say, first off, I'm not sure I do balance. And secondly, if that didn't happen overnight, you know, if I look good at balancing it now, it's because for a lot of years I couldn't balance mm-hmm. it, and then you feel it, then you realize you develop skills or ways to deal with it that then make it seem, at least externally, that you are balancing it. I've even had one of my students say that I can't get as excited about science as you do, so I'll never be successful. And that made me very sad. And I said, well, you know, maybe you haven't found your absolute passion yet. Obviously, this is my passion, and I'm glad that you can see mm-hmm. that it's my passion. But my passion doesn't have to be your passion. Mm-hmm. It just had to be enough for you to do your thesis. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure someday you'll find what yours is and go and run with it. And people will know just by looking at your face that mm-hmm. this is what you like. But it kind of upset me. I think she was saying it as a compliment. She's originally from China, this student. And I said, maybe some of it is cultural. But because I said, look, I have an Italian mother. I'm very expressive. And that could be why. Just maybe my mannerisms. Mm-hmm. Don't mm-hmm. obsess on that. And she just looked and said, I will never be like you. And I said, don't say never. You don't know that. And I have not always been this way. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how they pick up different things or take something that you would think is a positive and, you know, reflect it onto themselves and then see it as a bad thing.
Well, you know, the part about that sort of sixth sense about, you know, when to go on, when to shift gears, you know, among clinical people, that's called good clinical judgment. And some people have it and some people never get it. And the ones that have it are the ones that are really good clinicians, and the ones that don't aren't. So I'm not sure that everybody gets it eventually. I don't know.
It might be good to just, even if that's so, to tell them.
Yeah.
Because if you tell them that I'm not sure everybody will get it, then mm-hmm. they could be convinced that they're not going to get it. So I don't want to be the one to tell them that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're right about that. Uh-huh. Because some people do make mistakes. But I think that making those kinds of mistakes doesn't have to be fatal
in your
career. Maybe for clinicians, it could be fatal to some of the patients, but mm-hmm. For scientists, if every one of your decisions is bad, well, I suspect that you're not going to be in the business for your whole life, mm-hmm. or certainly research is not going to be your main focus. Mm-hmm. You can go down wrong paths. That's how you learn. Mm-hmm. So just because I feel I've been lucky in that I haven't stayed on any wrong path or hopped too soon. Mm-hmm. Because there were times with some things where you could say, you know, she's doggedly persistent mm-hmm. at that. At the same time, someone else could say, she's out of her cotton-picking mind, that's never gonna happen. Mm-hmm. Right? And then mm-hmm. it happened. If it hadn't, people who felt that I was out of my mind would have said, well, she was a glutton for punishment. Mm-hmm. I told her to drop that. The others would have said, gee, I never would have guessed, but I could see where it could have gone that way.
Sure.
So, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
I know when. Mm-hmm. But truthfully, I have never even started a project that hasn't ultimately worked. But one project has been a bear, and there have been times where we've slowed down, and I think it was more take a breather, mm-hmm. because sometimes you can just start feeling consumed by, mm-hmm. by you know, something that's not wanting to go forward
right.
at that time. But I've always considered it luck, mm-hmm. because I don't know why I make those decisions.
Yeah.
I just feel that way.
Yeah.
Which is so unscientific, but it's true.
Well. Well, you just mentioned, you know, that you can get consumed by something. So what do you do for fun so that you don't get consumed?
I love sports.
Mm-hmm.
I love volleyball, softball. I go to the gym, work out in the gym. I love to sing.
Oh.
I used to play the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I realized at a young age that I could be good at it, but I was never going to be great and relaxed with it. It was mm-hmm. not going to ever come easy to me. So I stopped playing, but I love to sing. I love rock music, pop music, so I go to concerts.
Mm-hmm.
Not the kind of concerts that many of my colleagues go to, but that's what I enjoy. I bicycle ride.
Mm-hmm. Do you sing anywhere
anything?
But in your shower? I mean, do you belong to a choral group or a choir?
No, I
don't. Karaoke or?
No. 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 I when I go to church, I make sure uh-huh. to go to a mass that sings, because uh-huh. it gives me an opportunity to mm-hmm. bellow as loud as I want uh-huh. in a way that is productive.
Mm-hmm.
Around the house, I'm always. In the car, I'm always.
Uh-huh.
With my nephew.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When he was little, the songs that I used to sing to him, my mother would go crazy. Why are you singing those songs to him? Because I would be singing Talking Heads songs, very hard rock or punk rock at the time, and she would say, Psycho Killer, why are you singing this to him? And I just said, it has a good beat, doesn't it? And so he'd be 3 years old and singing these tunes back, and my mother would go crazy. And I said, but it's good to make him feel comfortable with mm-hmm. singing and expressing himself. And still, now he's 10 and a half. Whenever we go anywhere, we in the car, I put on, you know, the radio mm-hmm. or a tape, and if he doesn't know the words, I teach him the words.
Mm-hmm.
And this summer I took him to his first concert, went to the Lilith Fair, which, if you're not familiar, it was organized by Sarah McLachlan, who's a Canadian pop singer, guitarist, piano player, who several years ago ran into the situation where several venues would not book her because the lead act was also a female artist. And what they said was that they would never be able to sell out. They wouldn't get the booking. They wouldn't pull in the money that they hoped to pull in. And that got under her skin. And she decided that she was going to prove the point that women were a significant presence in music, and that all female acts, all female billings, can indeed pull in huge audiences. And for the past three summers, she's toured with many, many female artists of different stages of their career development. Mm-hmm. So there are several stages that are set up. It's a fair. It's a about 5-6 hour long event, and there are many booths that are set up, and many of them are for good causes for women fighting against breast cancer, against domestic violence, and then they sell records or CDs mm-hmm. of the younger artists, so the upcoming ones. So they have small stages, village stages, and small stages where you can get very close to the artists, and new ones are kind of participate in a lottery to get time on those stages.
Oh, uh-huh.
And then very popular ones are on the main stage. So as the day goes on, the last four or five artists are all on the main stage. So we went out to Jones Beach to, you know, it's an open air theater, and I told him that we're going to go take you to a rock concert, and it's all women. And several of my friends and some of their husbands were coming with us. And we went around, and he was so excited. This was his first concert. And we went to one of the smaller stages, and a lesser artist got out there. And suddenly Sheryl Crow comes out and joins her on the stage. And I grab his shoulders. He's as tall as I am now. And I stick him right in front of me, and I said, "Look, she's famous! That's Sheryl Crow!" And then a minute or two later, out came Sarah McLachlan. And I went, "She's famous! That's Sarah McLachlan!" And then he goes, "You said that there were going to be all women artists, all women singers here. Where's Jennifer Lopez?" I said, "We don't do that kind of music! No!" I said, "Memorize this! Sheryl Crow, Sarah McLachlan." And then one of the groups that was playing on the main stage later were Chrissy Hynde and the Pretenders. Chrissy uh-huh. Hynde is 50-something years old, and she's still rocking. So Patrick was aware of some of her music because I used to sing Talking Heads and Pretenders songs to him when he was little. And he looks, and he was so proud, and he says to my friends, "I know that song," when she was singing. So when Sheryl Crow got out onto the main stage, she then sort of acknowledged that Chrissy Hynde was the best female rocker ever. And Patrick heard, she said, and "I'm honored to play with the best female rocker ever." And my nephew jumps up and he goes, "Aunt Maureen!" And my friends look at me, and I was so embarrassed. And then, so of course I jumped up. And then he goes, "The Pretenders is the best female rocker ever?" And I said, "That's okay. I'm happy you think it's me." So
that's cute. Yeah.
So I have the ability to bring my hobbies to my nephew.
Yeah.
So I play sports with him, And now it seems as though my little habit of singing songs to him, he's old enough now that I can take him with me to some of these concerts. So he was just so excited that he could go, and and probably thinks that all concerts now also have beach parties associated with it, because my friends and I made big picnic and brought that with us, and so I'm sure he has a convoluted view, or thinks that you get 10 acts that come out,
Well, he'll find out. Do you spend much time with TV or the internet? Those are big time sinks for a lot of people.
Neither. A little bit of TV a few times a week. I tend to watch shows that are completely decadent. A little science fiction. I love The X-Files. I often think, when I retire, I think I could sit on my porch and write such fantasy. I think I could have juiced that plot up a lot better than what they had. You know, those shows like that, sometimes I'll watch a comedy. Mm-hmm. I think it's healthy to be able to laugh at regular things. Mm-hmm. I listen, mostly in the evenings, I'll listen to CDs. Mm-hmm. That I have. Internet, I am such a non-technocrat. I'm not fond of computers. If you ask me to list my best friends, I could go on and on and on, or things that I love the most. Computers are not my friend. I'm all thumbs with them. The other thing is that I see that the few times that I jump onto the internet and start surfing around, I see you can really get absorbed in that. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have it at home. I'm going to try to do that for as long as possible. And I'm content to not do it, because I think that I could be one of the people that would be, you know, you log on and 5 hours later you realize, holy mackerel, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. I better get to bed. I have to get up soon. Mm-hmm. No, thank you.
Well, it's interesting that you said you're...
I'm not a technocrat.
You're not a technocrat, because in the sciences now, you know, technology is... I mean, revolutionized
there
genetics.
There are certain technologies that I just... want to have. Uh-huh. Chips. Microarrays. For microarray.
Arrays.
Oh. Microarrays. Okay. Or being able to put DNA on chips.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So they're microarrays that go onto these chips. And of course, I want to do that. I realize it's very expensive to do, and so I have pitched my projects to major pharmaceutical companies that have the resources and the teams to really do it correctly. Mm-hmm. So, in a certain sense, I'm a bit of a technocrat, because I could see that quick and could see the application, but I also saw the practical end of it, but I don't have a cell phone. I don't want a cell phone. And only this past Christmas did I even get a cordless phone as a gift. All my other phones had a wire attached to them. So I really am not, I'm not into all these gadgets. I don't want to read an instruction manual. I don't want to complicate everyday aspects of life.
Okay, let me change the tape.